Start recording before I need to, which is kind of a miracle. Welcome to the 22nd of January 2020 Aries Working Group call. I have some good stuff planned. I will drop the link in the chat. Please add yourself to the attendees if you'd like to. Please remember the code of conduct and the antitrust policy. We need to make sure that our work is perceived in a nice manner and is unencumbered by legal issues. So that's why we do that. This is probably the last time I'll make this announcement. There's an updated Hyperledger calendar. They're moving from the old one to the new one. If you have not corrected your appointments, please do so. And I'm going to pull that off next time. Do we need to keep the Aries 6 community coordination item on here for Aries VCR? VCGov team, anybody?
Kill it. Kill it.
Done. Okay. And a new one today, AJ, who I don't see on the call, at least yet, and Ironworks, I think is how you pronounce that. They have a new React Native Mobile Agent SDK. So I'll probably only mention this once, but wanted to link this if you are interested in a React Native Aries Mobile Agent. That's a darn good starting spot. So that's there. I will please add notes if you'd like to the remaining meetings, but we're not going to give it airtime. So the contributors is not this week. It is next week on Monday. Any contributors? I was thinking about the identity working group implementer calls. That is not this week. I believe that is going to be next week. The DIF DIDCOM working group is going. We are picking next week. We are coming up with a beginning outline of the output work of the spec, and we'll be taking volunteers to write various sections starting next week. Good. Okay. Upcoming releases and work updates. Anything on the test suite? Daniel?
I will call out Keith again for some more fantastic work on the test suite. He has a PR in for issue credential, and there's some ongoing discussion there, but we expect to see that entering the test suite pretty soon.
Yeah, I am reworking that per your comments. So in the process, I'll mention there were some, I think we're coming up with basically a layer at which we can define a provider interface, just like a back channel interface, and all of the indie specific calls will be defined in that provider interface.
Cool. This is for testing of credentials and stuff.
Correct. Obviously, you know, basically anywhere in the Aries protocol that we define an attachment, which is indie specific, you know, it's going to require calling out through this provider interface to do that. So a non-indie implementation could then implement that interface.
Awesome. Very cool. Any movement on Aries shared libraries?
Andrew continues his work on the indie VDR component. He's published the repo, so it's now visible to others. He's wrapping it in a web server so that it'd be called over a REST API. And then ACAPI he's going to do a experimental branch on ACAPI so that we can use it, demonstrate its use in a, you know, basically in a framework so that you can call that whenever you want to do ledger interactions, but the indie SDK is there for everything else that is relied upon for the indie SDK.
Cool. Very neat. While you're talking, Stephen. Oh, wait. Do we have a cam? I don't think we have a cam. Okay. Do you want to talk about ACAPI, Aries Cloud Agent Python?
Not a lot has changed in the last week, so nothing big there. The one thing we're doing is we're going to take the Akif did three sample controllers. I mentioned it last week. Rather than putting it in ACAPI, we are going to put it into a separate repo, Aries ACAPI controllers. And so those will be available, and we can add additional controllers. We've got at least one other we're aware of that can be put in there. So these will be different tech stacks and so on, but implement the ACAPI REST interface administration API.
Awesome.
We also, as mentioned, the ACAPUG meeting happened a little while ago, and we had fun.
Yes, I was going to mention that. So if you are a user of ACAPI, that's a useful place to be to figure out and coordinate updates to that code base. Awesome. Aries Firmware Go, Troy?
The usual update, the planning notes are posted. There was an initial scaffolding completed, so we can communicate from web page via JavaScript worker into the WASM. And now we're looking at how to abstract the controller administration REST API into common code that can be used via the WASM calls as well.
Very cool. Jack, any update on SDK Ruby? I don't hear him. Okay. JavaScript framework is usually pretty active. Any work on the Aries JavaScript and the SDK for JavaScript, Aries framework, SDK for JavaScript?
I think that's the group that's in India doing the React Native mobile app. So my guess is that.
Was that the same group?
I think so. That's Jay and his team.
Oh, you're right. It is.
Yeah. I think that having a React Native SDK available is going to be phenomenal. I think people are going to be really excited to see that.
That is pretty cool. Awesome. Any other updates on related work?
The one other thing I should mention is we have somebody working on Ozma, instead of using Agent Framework, which is the street cred pre-contribution to Hyperledger, bringing it up to use Aries Framework.net and using the 1.0 credential exchange protocol and things like that. Hopefully those will be coming pushed soon to the public repo. But if anyone's doing Ozma work, you can check in with me. It's Sukalpo Mitra that's doing it, and definitely check in with him to see what he's done. If you're going down that path, he might be able to save you some work.
Cool. And I heard another voice.
Yeah, it's Paul here. We didn't have a semantics call this week because Robert and I were at a Novartis hackathon working on these SSI solutions for third party risk management. But there's I just wanted to mention the pharma space because it looks like it's going to blow up, and the SSI community will hugely benefit from it. There's the Innovative Medicine Initiative is an umbrella kind of organization containing about 100 projects since 2014, and they've put in a blockchain-enabled healthcare, which is 12 huge pharma companies and 17 partners, which are like startups and universities, etc. So the official kickoff of that blockchain healthcare project was a few days ago in Prague. They've got this pharma ledger thing that they're doing, which is basically supply chain, clinical trials, health data, and they've earmarked initially 21 million euros for it. But I've heard through the grapevine that that's just a random figure and that the budget is actually unlimited. But the reason I bring it up is because because Novartis is really spearheading the whole thing. You've got a whole load of partners, but then they've got this kind of spearhead partner, which is Novartis. And Novartis are their most important project is this third-party risk management project, and they're using self-sovereign identity for that. So they want to use it pretty much for all their projects. So that's the first implementation of the overlays capture architecture, and they've already said to me that they want to use that for all of their projects as well. So all of this is great for the community. I'll keep people updated as we go. But yeah, it's all looking pretty positive.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. Are there any additional links you could share with us for that? For more info?
I will try and dig something out for you for sure. I mean, there was quite an interesting use case that how they're using SSI. They kind of want to use SSI for a level of trust, but they wanted to use kind of a workaround to distribute a huge health and safety questionnaire between parties. So they're kind of using something immutable for that transport, but just using the SSI for the signing stuff. And so we've put together a schema base of a very simple way of doing that. So I'll run that past Daniel and a few of the other guys in the community to see what that looks like. But it certainly works for their use case.
Very cool. Very cool. Thanks for bringing that up.
No problem.
Any other work updates before we move to our agenda? Okay, on the agenda today, we're starting out with the issue game, and I'm going to be running that. I've identified four issues that we can talk about. And then, Richard, hoping we can talk about the service decorator. That may be not a long conversation, and that's okay, but I think we should try and have it. Is that all right?
I'm having mic problems today, but yes, if you can hear me, it's all right.
Well, tell Mike to get his act together, and it's no problem. Okay, so then I have some notes about the continued Connection Blues conversation on a couple of different topics. And we have talked about these at the end of meetings before, and it hasn't gotten its own time. And so that I placed there to try and further the conversation on some important issues that we want to deal with. And then Stephen Curran has some this is not a great title, Stephen, but I put in they've been doing performance testing on the community holder code, BCGov, what's the right name? I didn't come up with the right one.
It's close enough. Performance testing when you're in high volume ARIES protocol situations.
Right.
That's not a good title either. The actual title on the slide deck is called Press F2 to go faster.
All right, F2, this will confuse everyone. Now everyone's going to want to know what F2 is. Okay. So issue game, let's launch right in. The first one on the list is 290. This was a discussion that we continued this recently, but I'm kind of wondering where we are and whether we can, what we ought to be doing about this. This is the discussion about whether we are using Base64 URL padding or no padding. Kyle started it. There's been some discussion back and forth. And then 9 days ago, the comment was made by Kyle that we should figure out how this applies to AIP 1.0.
Pretty sure we talked about it last week. We would leave it as it is done in the implementations and defer any other changes until JWM work and diff work is done.
So should we update?
Isn't that what we decided?
I think that's what we decided.
Yeah.
I'm looking for Kyle.
I'd like to call out that there is a bit of a difference though in between the implementation. So we kind of need to say whether we're going to accept both or whether we're going to stick with or without padding. This was actually something that Tomislav and I were working out earlier today with differences in the
test okay.
and the .NET framework. So,
okay.
So the .NET framework does it one way, and then the other implementations do it another way. Is that what I'm hearing?
So the RFCs specify to use Base64 URL encoding. However, the Python implementation of URL safe Base64 encode and decode expects padding, but the Base64 URL spec, I don't know. I'm not sure what to call it exactly, but it says not to include padding. So there's a difference between Python and other languages in whether padding is expected or not.
Awesome.
So I think this is Johnny. I was actually mistaken last week that there's actually specific terminology for there's four terms in RFCs in IETF. And I think the looking at the specification for the crypto suites, it's without padding. So there's base64 URL, which means it transfers three characters into different characters that are URL safe, but without padding, I think reading the specification is preferred.
So no padding is preferred in the specification. We currently have two. It sounds like .NET defaults to using it with no padding. And Python defaults to
all other default implementations and languages besides Python default to without padding on URL safe base64 encoding.
So what's the right answer here for AIP 1.0.0? The deferring of future stuff, I think, is the right answer. But I think for the sake of AIP, of the Aries interoperability profile, we should pick one. Is there a non-trivial and fairly easy way to just accept both? Is that something that we should try and do, or should we just try to pick one and go there?
That's where I think, multi-hashing, encoding, which is what we use, actually, you prepend and you define what the encoding is in. And there are basically four different possibilities. So as long as you're specific and use, let's say, like a multi-base, then you're safe. Or somehow otherwise encoded.
Well, we don't do that now, so we'd have to switch to that if we were. So the question is for the sake of the interoperability profile 1.0, what do we want to do?
I mean, if I'm understanding correctly, it would just be the decode that would have to be able to basically try one way. Is it an option in the decode, or what happens in decode? Either can you tell if it's...
Yeah, it just strips the last three characters that are the separators in the URL. So, and my understanding is that JWS, most crypto suite libraries in the specification prefer no padding. But I could be mistaken. I defer to Kyle.
The padding, the problem is I don't think we have a Kyle. The problem is that we... The padding is there in order to make sure that it's always the same number of bytes, which means that the number of padding characters on the end will vary. So on one, you could just strip them off. If you get them and you see any, you could just remove them from the end of the string before you try to process it, right? Adding them back in is a little more problematic because you have to add the right number of them back in. Stephen, what's your intuition on the right thing to do here?
Well, I mean, I don't know this stuff at the level. I mean, ideally, just on decode, you try both, but I don't know whether that's possible. I don't know what, you know. Because then it doesn't matter. The decoder just figures it out. But I don't think
the interoperability profile can say, you know, you must be able to decode both. That's a choice we could make.
No, okay. So that's my question to the developers. Is it possible to be given a base64 encoded string and decode it?
Well, if you can be given a padded and decode it without padding, right? That's right. The question: is the padding versus no padding? Yeah. So how hard is it to accept both?
From my understanding, it is not too difficult to accept both.
Yeah. If that's possible, then we should definitely do that.
Sure.
I just placed a link in the chat that seems to imply, if this is an accurate thing that I pasted, that it implies that to get from a with padding to, sorry, with pat, yeah, it seems like there's more than just trailing characters here. But anyway, I think more investigation is needed.
So
we'll take it.
You're going to do the investigation.
We'll take it on and try to get. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll get help on my side, and we'll try to come up with a proposal. Ideal proposal is that that on decoding, you don't know. You shouldn't assume. You should and try both. But again, I don't know if that's technically possible. It sounds good to me, but Just have to verify what's technically possible, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, so we're going to figure that
Thanks
out.
Thanks for the links. Yes. The links are really helpful. Appreciate it.
Johnny Crunch got another one in there, too, and here's another one from Daniel.
And Daniel's got another one. Excellent. Thanks, guys.
So we're not going to close this one, and the BCGov team is going to take on figuring out what our options are.
Yeah.
Okay. Next one up is issue 77. This is this was opened by Tobias Lookert. It was the encoding byte for content type of envelope and content messages. And so what this was, what this brought up, and we may just, we have a couple of options on how we deal with this one. But we talked about an encoding character. This does make sense. The question is should we ignore this for the sake of the ongoing DIDCOM work over in the DIDCOM working group in the diff? And to that end, I've actually already added the DIDCOM related tag to this one. Should we just ignore this one and leave it for DIDCOM related so that that group can pick up these issues? Meaning, we leave it open.
As person opening the issue, I'm happy to do that.
Okay. The other thing I'll mention here is that there's quite a number of these. I've got 9 tagged as DIDCOM related. Meaning if there's some urgent, and the reason we don't close them here is because the other group is not yet we're almost to the stage where we could transition these over to issues in the other group, and then we could close them here. But these are all the ones that relate to that. Okay, so we're going to ignore that one for now. This is issue 225, opened by Troy in September. There's been a lot of movement on this, including a couple RFCs on how to actually do this. And so all the way down to the end, the issue here, or the last comment was by Daniel, talking about how LF is being weird. Maybe we just want to get the diff to do this. This is not precisely DIDCOM related, but it's close enough. Should I apply the same tag and apply the same rules to the DIDCOM related issues? Objections?
I think that would be fine. The fact is, it would be nice to clean this up, but it's not actually holding anybody up, because what we're talking about here is hosting documentation for DIDCOM related topics. As long as we know that the URI we're talking about is going to be at didcom.org, we can start using that even though we don't actually have any content there, and then we can fiddle with the publication later.
That's a super good point. So
it would be nice. So go ahead, Sam, and then I got a comment.
Nope, you go ahead first.
Okay, so two things. One is, it would be nice to come up with the mechanics of how this would actually work, because right now all of our specifications are actually within a README file in GitHub. But the way this is worded, there would actually be a document at didcom.org/didexchange/1.0/invitation. So it'd be nice to get the mechanics worked out. You know, again, Daniel's right. It doesn't have to actually work, but the mechanics, we should be able to be following now. Because right now, as I say, they just go to the only to the README. Maybe the mechanics are there. Second point was, we have a community transition document, and we now have AIP 1.0, and I'd like to put those into accepted state. So I'm going to later today change those, put a PR in for those to go to accepted. I guess we still have to have a service decorator discussion, but both of that would address this one, which is getting the transition in process.
Yes. Which is part of this. The other issue is actually getting the URL there, but since the process doesn't actually resolve the document yet, it's kind of two separate issues. One is we should update it to move away. The second one is, let's get the domain there. Okay. Right. So I'm going to leave this one open, tag the DIDCOM, which we're semi just preserving, and I'll try and get an effort undergoing this week or next week to actually move these and link to the closed version in this repo. And that way we can actually close these out and not have them hanging around. That would be helpful. Okay. So that one's, we know what we're doing with that one. Last one This is 122. This was opened by Kyle. So it's unfortunate he's not here today. And he was talking about replacing custodial agent to replace cloud agent, or non-custodial replacing edge. This was Stephen, Kyle, Daniel, John, all commented on this. And this sort of ended up with a, okay, we should probably not change this type of resolution. Is anyone opposed to closing this with a note? No one's opposed. Okay, I'm going to close this one with a note that it can be reopened if we need a further discussion. And I think otherwise this one is done. Okay, so the other thing that I'd love to mention here real quick too is that the number of issues we have open is 25. That's about to be 24. And 9 of them are actually tagged with DIDCOM related, which should transition over to another issue repo, which means we're looking at like 15 open issues, which is beginning to get to a healthy stage. So the issue game is working. I'd like to thank everyone for your participation. Awesome. Anything else before we go to Richard? Richard,
can you talk about the service?
Yep, I can.
Excellent. This silly headset finally works. First is apology. Jack asked me to apologize that he can't make it today. But he did want to report that he's continuing to make progress on the Ruby framework, and he encourages other people to participate. As for the service decorator, our thanks to the help of the BCGov team, our questions are answered. So thank you for that. So I'm okay with moving the AIP 1.0 profile to accepted. I appreciate people letting us really engage and figuring out, making sure we have a common understanding about these things. And I encourage other people to really dig in so that the AIP is well understood before we all commit to supporting it.
Would you mind summarizing your concerns and what the answer was, Richard?
Daniel might be better at it, but the concern was, there are two concerns. The first was that we were worried that that we hadn't had time to adequately review the RFC, and we've had both of our architects go through and review it and feel like we have much better understanding. The concrete concern that made us think that we needed to go through a detailed review was that we weren't exactly sure about how a response return endpoint would be defined if there were multiple tiers, multiple hops in the communication. So if you have to go through a cloud agent and another mediator of some sort, in Evernym's terms, a cloud agent and agency, would that work? And Andrew Whitehead responded that he believes it'll work. But what was more important for us is that he committed to implementing a test case to prove that it works on the ACAPI side. So at least we'll have functional interoperability. But we felt like where we thought that the RFC was ambiguous probably does define it adequately. Daniel, anything that I missed or hashed up there?
No, I think that's a good summary.
Awesome. Thank you for that. And so with that, I think that was the last remaining issue for open as part of AIP 1.0.0, right, Stephen?
Yes. And apologies that I was out last week too. Thanks for being flexible.
Sure. Awesome. So AIP 1.0.0 should be pretty close to being done here.
Yeah, I'm going to put what I'd like to do with AIP 1.0 is put in the, I'll put it in. I guess actually, should we add the HTTP transition for the message types, step one of that transition, or do we just AIP 1.0 being what we have today?
I would love to have the step transition because that gets us one important step closer and it's not that complicated of an update.
It's not. Richard, would that break you?
Well, I'm obviously nervous about anything changing from what we're almost done implementing.
Yeah.
Regardless of the difficulty.
All right.
So I'll have to go back to my team.
Okay. I'm going to propose. I'm going to propose the pull request go forward, do a PR for AIP to move it to accepted state. I'll check to see if there's any other updates on the protocol. So one of the things I wrote a quick and dirty script that tells me if any of the versions are out of date with the current master. any of the links to the particular protocols. So I will check that one more time. If there are clarifications, I will make adjustments as part of this, but otherwise just change it to accepted. And when that pull request is merged, it'll be in accepted. I think we should leave it a week before that. So I'll put that in and then we can discuss it at the next week's call to finalize that.
Awesome.
Hopefully that works with everyone.
Yeah, apologies for the remedial explanation that I need. When you're talking about the step change transition in the message type, what exactly are you talking about?
We're talking about the transition from the did, the magic did that we had originally used is the root for common protocols to the HTTP URI. In step one, both the old and the new. So what this looks like from a code perspective is that you check an inbound message type. If it's you know, one, you change it to the other one and the rest of your code continues to process. So future steps require you to start defaulting to sending out the new one, but originally it's only receiving, and it's a pretty simple code change to convert one to the other one.
So I remember the conversation about that, but I don't remember where the link is describing what is being requested. Is there a specific RFC where it's talking about adding to AI?
Yes, there is a specific RFC about that. It's in the features, should be near the last. I can find it anyway. I can post it in the link.
Yeah, I want to make sure I'm talking about exactly the right thing when I talk about
it. Yeah, but it is a code change that the libraries have to do.
348
sounds right.
Position message type to HTTPs, yes.
Yeah, so it's got a three-step program. I tried to make it a 12-step, but I couldn't. So it's a three-step program where as soon as we make it accepted, we get people to transition to update their code bases to accept incoming in the old and new, but nobody would ever. So all that is asking is that during step one, they update their code. Nobody would ever send out a new one. So you would only ever get old ones. So during step one, actually, it would be really good to accept that and put that into the AIP because it doesn't require any code changes before the AIP goes into effect. And no one should ever receive one without. It's only when step two triggers that things could actually break if an implementation has not done step one.
Yes.
So it is reasonable to do it. You will not have to change. In other words, you don't have to change a line of code for us to include this step one in AIP.
Yeah, this would be where I'm fundamentally. My vision for AIP's purpose differs a bit from both of you, that I'm much more concerned about encoding what we're doing today than I am about figuring out the transition of the future. I'd rather do that as a separate initiative. I mean, if we have to implement it, we've got to test for it to prove that we're implementing it, or else there's no point in including it. And if we're not ever going to use it under the current one, why are we including it at all? And don't we want to get this done quickly instead of starting this next step before we can accept the AIP?
As I said, it doesn't matter. Okay, we'll take it off.
So I would propose taking it off because I think it moves us forward quicker, but I will go back to my team and we'll work on getting it implemented.
So to be clear, the downside of taking it off is that we are going to have an AIP update sooner rather than later because we want to move this forward in the community. Which means we already know that this particular RFC will be in to do the transition of step one will be in the next version of the AIP that will come relatively shortly. So there's a trade-off here. One is that we do it in 1.0.0 and it goes through easy. The other side is that we do 1.0.0, but very quickly the one that we really want people to do is the next version of an AIP.
Well, I think we already have lots of reasons why we want people to move to the next version of the AIP when they can. We've got the new connections.
Let me say one more reason why it's useful to have it in there. Step one requires that code bases start to make a change. They don't have to make the change on day one. So there is literally no change to make prior to declaring your AIP compliant. The change has to occur during that so that when we update it the next time, you will have to have completed this step. You will have been expected to have completed that step. So you actually don't have to make any code changes at all in order to still be AIP compliant. It's just during this phase, this next up till the next release of an AIP, you have to have made the change. So your code change doesn't have to happen until the next time.
And that's where I struggle. I don't understand how you have a standard. It's a binary. You're either compliant or you're not. I don't know how you say my current code base doesn't do this, but
The way it's written, I agree with you, Richard. The way it's written, it basically says during step one, in order to be step one compliant, if you will, which is what we'd include in the AIP, that you already have to be able to accept old and new.
No. Okay, let's leave it at this. We're down a rabbit hole that we don't need to be with everyone on the call.
Yeah, okay. And just because I have a concern doesn't mean we have to make a decision today. I think leaving it open and getting feedback from people in other time zones is a fine thing to do.
Okay. Perfect. We've talked about the service decorator. Anything further on that before we talk about connection blues?
No, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Richard, for giving us a summary of that. That had been on the list for a couple of weeks, so we finally addressed that issue and it's done. So we talked about the connection blues. Stephen talked about it. I had some additional commentary, and I've pulled out three things, and I've just left the notes right here in the document in lieu of a separate slide deck, although I can bring up the other deck if we need to. There's a couple of different issues here that I think that are very worth talking about and trying to figure out. The main one is using DIDs to or reusing an existing connection. The classic example that for Stephen give, for example, is that they have their service which will validate your email address, right? You scan a QR code, you get connected, it'll help you, it'll send you a magic link to click on in your email. You click on it, and then they'll issue a credential of email ownership. The problem there is that if you go verify another one, maybe a second email address, or you go to want it to be reissued, you end up with two invitations to their service, which is annoying. And of course, you can imagine all sorts of things like this. If you have a QR code to make it easy for people to use with mobile agents to do things, you're going to end up with multiple connections unless we make an effort to do that. So one of the proposals that I had was that, and this is particularly useful for organizations, and it's not useful for individuals that wish to remain anonymous, but the major use case right now is with organizations. And if your invitation starts from a public DID and then ends up in a pairwise relationship even, then you could, that public DID is a correlating factor that you could use. So the invitee who is scanning an invitation should, under this model, remember that public ID was related to the peer connection that ended up as a result. When the invitee scans a different one from the same person in the future, the public DIDs can match, and then they can of course look through their list of existing public DIDs in this manner to determine if they could reuse a connection or not. So now's when I be quiet and I listen. Is this a good idea?
Yeah, we actually already do this. That's exactly how we do it.
Awesome. Any frustrations or any issues with this approach? I'll mention that it specifically does not solve a problem of two individuals discovering that they already have a connection because they don't have public DIDs in that case. And I believe that's a good future topic, but it's not really an on-fire one at the moment.
Well, so are we requiring that the individual disallow this, or are we saying the individual has the option of disallowing it?
You mean of not using a public? I don't understand your question.
So if I'm an individual, do I have the option of establishing a second connection with this public?
You absolutely do have that option.
Okay.
So I use can, not must be looked up. We should make that more obvious wherever we encode this, because there's certainly a really good option to show up and not have a correlated, you know, not have the connection correlated with something else, which is, I think, why you're getting that, Daniel.
Yeah.
So is there a different response that you send to an invitation where you discover you already have the connection? I'd actually wandered off for a moment, so I apologize, Sam. I'm in part of your...
Let me try to say with a few more words what you're getting at, and you can tell me if I get it right or not. It's right now, it's currently a behavior that we've used, because why not, to respond after a connection is made with some other action. For example, the BC Gov service that verifies ownership of email address on completing the connection automatically does a thing. And what they're doing is they want to help you get a credential that verifies email ownership. So the question here is that if we're not completing the connection protocol, is there another way to signal to the other side over your existing connection that you wish to sort of engage in whatever? That relates a little bit to my connect then invitations. I believe the implicit pattern that we've begun to use for our demos is probably harmful, meaning there's the client or the, you know, the Alice in this case, Alice connects to Bobco, or Alice connects to the email verification service using a public DID. Alice may not understand that upon completion of something, some other protocol is going to engage. And Alice, that might be the desirable thing. But it strikes me that we have an or a connect then flow here, where you're going to connect and then you're going to engage in some other thing. And it's possible for the service to begin a protocol at the end of a connection, or, you know, the connection protocol completing. But sometimes we actually want the other side, the person who's doing, you know, the invitee after connection is completed, to start a protocol. And right now we do it implicitly from the other side. And so one of my thoughts, Stephen, is that instead of trying to formalize the process of saying, hey, I'm connecting again, but I'm using the same connection, we would try to figure out what the connect then flow was, so that we can actually use that in a more common and more explicit way. Under that scenario, if Alice detects that she already has a connection from that public DID, she would skip the connect part of that and go right to the then part of that and begin the next protocol over the existing connection. Thoughts?
I don't really like it, because she doesn't know what the next step is. She doesn't know what the protocol is. When she connects to a service, she doesn't know, for instance, she doesn't really know what the next
protocol. I'm proposing that the invitation contains the then, so she doesn't have to know. So
it means that every protocol has to be two-sided. In other words, either party can initiate it, which we don't have yet.
That's true. That's a super good point. So the connect then seems to work well if you want Alice to initiate it after the connection. But Bobco, right, with the public DID.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't necessarily say anything.
I'll use this to pitch an idea we've had that we still haven't written in RFC for, but it is what Andrew called the action menu, which is kind of like a IVR, you know, system on phones, where you say press 1 for this, press 2 for this, press 3 for this. That one of the things you can always could always do is send me the menu of options, and that gives a way for the initiator to always say, oh, what can you do for me? And B, for the responder to always provide, oh, here are the bunch of trigger points and you can do different things.
I think action menu is related, but I think slightly orthogonal to this flow.
Yeah. I mean, it would give us a generic way of Alice initiating something. That's all I was saying by that.
It would be, there's, I have, other issues with the Action Menu protocol. I love part of it and I lament part of it. And so I think it's a little bit complicated.
Yeah. Digression.
So what you're saying though, you're right, is that it doesn't make sense to tell Alice that Bobco is going to do something after she connects, nor would that necessarily mean that she would have to send a message to say, okay, now do the thing. And that's the same thing as a message in the invitation or the connection protocol that says, hey, we're already connected. And here's the invitation I did not duplicate. Right?
Right. Yep.
In which case, that could be the trigger. It would basically skip to the end of the connection protocol, and that could be the trigger to initiate whatever action you wanted.
Yeah, and that's what I was proposing, was that there be a second method that allowed you to A, respond, and B, in that response, allow the inviter to link your response to the invitation that they posted so that they would know what to do. So in our email service, once you connect, it posts another page that lets you see the status of the process. Oh, we've connected. Now we're issuing a credential and we're waiting on you to respond. So it has to know to what web page to send that. And so it has to know that it's associated with the session that the web session that the person just connected via. So they have, you know, the service has to know that even though this came in on a connection, it's associated with the invitation.
Right. So the new message would say, I'm going to use this existing connection, but exercise a new invitation with the relevant invitation details.
Yeah.
I think semantically that works.
Yeah.
I think we still need a connect then, but it does not overlap this particular case.
So
yeah,
it feels to me like we're inverting the semantic emphasis here. Connect then assumes that the primary goal is to connect, or that that's the right way to think about it. But from the user's perspective, it will always be the then, where connection is a secondary detail. Right.
Mm.
So what you're really doing when you put a QR code on a web page is probably saying, why don't I give you a credential, or let me sign you up for something or whatever. It's the then part. And what you want that QR code to do is initiate a workflow that ends up on the final thing, where the connection is a momentary bump in the road.
And it's a byproduct of the main goal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the right way to think about it is to say the invitation protocol, I think Stephen already brought this up as a different idea, that we separate out the invitation protocol from connection or did exchange. They're two logically separate things. And we say all invitations, or at least it's possible anyway, to say any given invitation is an invitation to engage in a particular workflow, and it's never just connect, it's engage in workflow X. And if connection needs to happen, you can say in your invitation, either I'll only do this with you if we're already connected, or you can say, I'm happy to connect first, let's do that if we need to.
So that aligns something in my head, Daniel, that I hadn't aligned before, which was there's two modes of sort of doing the QR interaction. One is connectionless, and Tobias has talked about that, and the other one does have a connection. And what you're saying is that the thing you do is more important than whether you have a connection or not. And then
and then
what you can do is you indicate whether you desire a connection to exist as a byproduct or not. And that's sort of handled semantically in a separate way.
Yeah.
So the invitation protocol then could be, could indicate the connection versus connectionless difference, and could also indicate what the first step should be. Because in a way, you're inviting the so let's say for credential issuance, right? You are inviting the you know, Bob Coe is inviting Alice to to begin or to send a credential. I guess that would be like the credential offer, but yeah, right. Where they send a credential offer, and then Alice would start the process to receive a credential. In the authentication use case, the SIOP stuff, it's that first message more or less contains a presentation request, right?
Yeah.
So maybe we don't have an explicit invitation message necessarily, but we have a way to indicate whether you should engage in creating a connection or not that could be then, you know, sent along with any other type of protocol.
Yeah, it sounds like maybe it's a start protocol message, which could have an attachment letting you get fairly flexible about what that start is, but remembering that you're sending it over a
insecure
line, and it could come back with a connection first or with a or on a existing connection.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, well, do we want to just let it simmer for a while, or?
Yeah, I think so.
I think
that's
so.
That's giving me some ideas. Yeah.
So
to, we want to. Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say to skip back up here. I think we need to encode the stuff we've talked about here about retaining the public DID so that you can decide whether you want to create a new one or use an existing one. But that's not written anywhere, and I'm proposing that we write that into an RFC somewhere.
We're not seeing that your screen, so up there is.
So when I highlight stuff, it doesn't make sense?
Nope.
Thank you for calling out my idiocy. Okay, so what I'm saying is, back up to this section here, the using DIDs to, you know, the retaining the public DID after you make a connection, and then deciding whether to or not to reuse an existing connection, I think that ought to be codified in an RFC somewhere. There didn't seem to be a lot of disagreement about that practice. And it's one we can use nearly immediately, except in the case of, you know, we talked about adding a new message, right? A new data exchange message from the invitee saying, I'm going to use this existing connection. And so we could do that. It strikes me that perhaps the DID exchange RFC is the right place to put this as our sort of next thing.
So the only thing I can think of is does it have to be a DID? I mean, I guess I'd have to think of what's the danger of somebody posting a QR code where you go respond to somebody you already have a connection with, even though they didn't actually issue it, something like that. Is that a risk? I mean, that's the only thing I'd wonder.
You don't want someone to be able to spoof it.
Meaning, but what does spoofing it mean if you respond back on the same connection that you already have with them?
Well, I could trick you into taking an action that the invitee didn't really intend. I could trick an invite. If I spoof an invite, we can do something besides the public DID, but we'd need to make sure that it was verifiable, meaning it was signed by the invitee or the inviter, so that the invitee can't be spoofed into beginning a transaction that the invite that the inviter never intended. The nice part about a public DID. Well, it's not the only way we can do it. But it's one that's like pretty close to, I mean, we've already got someone doing it. We just never formalized that, right? We never talked about that openly as a useful mechanism for connection reuse. So
I'll think about it. Yeah, I wasn't a fan when I first heard it. I'll have to think about it more. Okay, no problem.
Okay, so and to be clear, I totally think there's other mechanisms that could be more useful in richer ways. But the public DID one seems to be an easy one that's already been done by a community member, so we know it works, right? And has relatively low side effects of doing. We don't have to really change anything to do it. We just have to change expected practices, which we can do by updating the RFC. Does the DID exchange RFC appear to be the right place to stick that wording to encourage that in the future?
Uh, I'd like to put it in connection as well, but it depends on the progress Did Exchange is going to make in diff.
Well, we can do a Did Exchange ourselves if they're not ready, if they have not yet produced a document for that, right?
Well, we've been waiting. I'm not altogether sure. I've never quite understood why Did Exchange is held up. So if we could revisit why it is and go forward.
The only thing that I'm aware of is the writing around inline key representations, and then that's it. Okay. I think everything else is ready to move forward with it.
Okay. Although the question of separating out invitation now becomes a question.
I don't think we need to yet. Well, that's a separate, we do need to discuss the right way to handle, which protocol is which. But in this, it doesn't show up in this particular case necessarily, because this QR code I scan, I'm either going to be compatible with or I'm not going to be compatible with. Right? Meaning, if I scan one and it's a Did Exchange invitation versus a connection invitation, then my phone will either get it or not get it. But
okay.
But to not squirrel on that too much, the other thing that I'd like to talk about is there's practical limits on the size of a QR code. So when we reach a QR code that's relatively rich, which I think we can do pretty easily, one of the common things to do is use a URL redirector. So you have a shortened URL that makes the QR code much easier to scan. And then, similar to the way URL redirectors work, you do a get on the URL, and it might return to you the larger contents of the message that you then didn't want to shove into the QR code and make it difficult to scan. This strikes me as something that could be great or awful, depending on how you do it. Certainly, there are some security implications, right? If you create the URL with this information, then it's, at least in its current form, is just in plain text, so it may not be able to be manipulated, but it could certainly be viewed, and that may not be a thing we want to do. So the question is there a way to do this safely? And I have an interesting rough idea on how we could actually do this with DIDCOM itself, which could prevent a third party from being involved. Any thoughts on safe URL redirectors for embedding those in QR codes?
I know we've got one in the VC op-ed that Tobias and the Matter Global team did, and we're using it. I don't know much about it, except that it works. It doesn't redirect to a third party in any way. It just redirects to another, from one URL on the same server to another URL on the same server.
But that requires the agent to have a built-in redirector in order to have it be on the same server.
So
I don't know.
I'm not opposed to this idea. I think it's fine, but I think we might be underutilizing another option, and that is an attachment. I wonder if we ought to
say
one possibility is we can attach a larger message, because attachment already has the possibility of saying you can go fetch this attachment from place X. And you could put lots of detail in the attachment and then just have your basic message be a primitive one that has nothing but an attachment. So it triggers the redirect, but it...
I like it.
Anyway, that's just a random thought that popped in my head.
It's a super good one. If you have, I believe attachments have a way to indicate the CR, some sort of integrity check of the thing you link to, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Which means that you could actually do that. I wonder, this may be a misapplication of this concept, but I wonder if you could encrypt the attachment and then tell them in the attachment how to decrypt it.
So the MIME type is specified when you attach, and you could specify either this is a plain text attachment or this is an encrypted DIDCOM message as the MIME type. There's two different MIME types for DIDCOM messages, one for plain text.
So if you didn't know the person that you were sending the message as an attachment, let's say you had an invitation that had an attachment, right? You might not know who's going to be decrypting it, which means you could actually stick the decryption information in the attachment itself. You could say, here's the key to use the decrypt the attachment, and you're passing it, of course, along a different band than wherever the attachment is stored, which means that that's a bit of a better security issue too. You're going to stick an encrypted blob at some location, and then you're telling the person where it is and the key to unlock it.
Yeah.
I really like that.
Yeah, so this is how we're overloaded the use of fragments to do the decryption in our solution.
Can you say more about that?
Yeah, so one thought, and actually in the DID specification for IP ID, is that in this whole discussion about matrix parameters, so fragment identifiers are supposed to be in traditional HTML, are supposed to identify a fragment of the HTML as an ID or XML for that matter. But and they are, browsers do not pass the fragment. So anything after a hash, typical web browsers are not supposed to pass that to the server side, which makes it ideal for actually just piecing some hidden information. So it's not necessarily agreed upon that this is best practice, but this is how we've been sort of, it's a hackish sort of approach, because browsers aren't supposed to pass anything after the hash fragment. That's supposed to be resolved locally. And basically, if you're in an HTML page, you're actually like supposed to go to that anchor tag in the HTML page. So, and this is the whole debate as far as matrix parameters and hash fragments and whether or not to pass keys for decryption in the hash fragment. So we're still using it, but we're actually using it in a way that the hash fragment identifies an IPFS resource. And then there's some query parameters after that. So again, those query parameters aren't part of identifier, but they are used, we're in basically in a, like a script, a JavaScript, you actually can fetch the entire URL, including the fragment from the browser window in the window object and use that for the decryption. Again, not best practice, but that's what we're doing.
Right. So some validity to the point where including some metadata along with the location of where it is could be useful. It strikes me that this is probably only useful for QR codes, because otherwise you might just want to send it, or maybe not. Maybe you have a bandwidth constrained connection and you don't want to send the whole attachment. But it strikes me that having a message that says bigger attachment over here could be useful. And then that the attached message, DIDCOM message, could be almost anything, and that could be useful in a lot of circumstances, certainly the QR code case. And if we did that, it would allow the secure use of I think that would improve the security of sort of URL shortening, if you will. That's not that actually different from what I had been thinking, but I think it's better than what I had been thinking. I was thinking about an expanded message protocol where you have a message that says, here's just the information to make a request, a connectionless request, right? So that would be an encrypt to retrieve a larger message. And that's functionally what the extra location and attachment kind of does anyway. And so that would be interesting. It would be nice if we had a way to indicate that the attachment could be fetched over DIDCOM, meaning you wouldn't have to drop to HTTP necessarily to do that. And then what you could do is you have the expand message protocol or whatever it is under this mental model. You would include just that message would include just the information required to go fetch it. And then you would then fetch it and then act on the message that you received in return, which would be, the larger pieces of the things. I don't think we need to decide this right now, but I wanted to bring it up and talk it out a little bit so we could stew on it a little bit. And thank you, Daniel, for bringing up attachments. Okay, is there anything else that anyone wants to talk about on these topics before we give Stephen some time? All right. Thank you, everyone, for that discussion. That was very helpful to me. And Stephen, you're up, right? Perfect.
Yes. Okay, hopefully people can see my screen. I'm looking at the right screen. Let me get my... All right, so I had a guy who found a line in code that said in an application you could press F2 to go faster. So his keyboard had the F2 key mashed down because he always wanted things to go faster. Experiences in Aries scaling. So this is a presentation that Richard asked me to put together based on a lot of work we did in getting Aries high volume transactions scaling to a satisfactory degree. BC Org Book is the use case. It's a community holder. Hopefully people know a fair bit about it. A community holder of public information. So the BC Registries is the authorized registrar of organizations in BC. So corporations, trusts, public organizations. There's about 500,000 organizations in BC, and we generate about 2.7 million credentials to for about those organizations. And then we issue them all to the Org Book, which is, as I say, a community holder. All of the data in the credentials is public, and that provides foundational credentials on every organization. Whenever we add a high volume issuer to Org Book, such as BC Registrar, we have to load all of their historical ones, all of the ones from 1850 forward. And we need to load that as quickly as possible. Past experience with Org Book V1, we were able to get about 2,600 credentials a minute and load the entire, that would load 2.7 million credentials in about 17 hours. When we first came up, we loaded fewer credentials than that, but now it would take 17 hours for that initial load. Feel free to jump in anytime, ask questions. This is the architecture of the Aries version of this. So version one, I'll talk a bit about this, but the Aries version, we've got a source system where all the data is. We're just looking at it with an event monitor. Every time an event occurs that triggers a credential to be issued, we send it over to the issuer controller. It talks to the issuer itself, which is the Akamai agent in this case. It's got its KMS Plus wallet. I call it a KMS Plus wallet. It issues the credential using Aries protocols to the Org Book credential registry, so to a holder prover there. That saves it in the wallet. I hate to use the term wallet. I was bound and determined not to use the word wallet. The KMS Plus database, and it also sends it to the controller, which stores the data in a search database. So 2.7 million credentials coming across, going through the Aries protocol, getting past the controller, getting put in a search database with Aries KMS plus storage per agent. Keys plus connections plus credentials plus protocol state is what I'm calling KMS plus in this case. We're using indie secrets and non-secrets for that. So that's context. Hopefully that's enough. Scaling. There's a couple of things. Everything's on OpenShift, which is Kubernetes, except the source system. So everything else is running on a scalable system. We can auto scale it. For those interested, we're actually using just a Postgres data wrapper to connect and monitor the Oracle DB that's involved. Transports are all HTTP. So everywhere that you see a red line except to the databases. Other than to the databases, those are all HTTP. Scalable, the issuer, holder, and the holder controller are all scalable. So if they're too slow, we can turn up the dial, get multiple instances of those running. Everything else pretty much is non-scalable. So we can have one event monitor, one issue controller, and one of each of the databases. The issuer controller is non-scalable because we use an in-memory cache. And the databases, we are using an enterprise-grade database, Postgres, on enterprise hardware, so that's not really an issue. When we talk about our scale notation, you'll see in the presentation is 1, 2, 2, 2, which means one of these, two of these, two of these and two of these. So that's how we, and when we're scaling it up, what it means for us. We had done a V1 architecture that got us to about 26,000 credentials. We used an entirely custom protocol for that. So this predates Aries. We were just using bespoke architecture. There was one offer, one request, one credential offer, one credential request, and then we would issue many, many credentials using just those. No interface, no HTTP between the agent and the controller. They were a single component. We did lots of batching. We would send over 100 credentials at a time so that we would reduce the number of HTTP calls. There was no protocol state between them. It was strictly a request response system. So lots of optimizations there. The apps outside of the agents are more or less the same. The source system and the event monitor is essentially the same. What is now the credential registry controller and the search database, those stayed more or less exactly the same. So coming back to that, these pieces down in the bottom corner here, they stayed essentially, or this corner here, they stayed essentially the same. Scaling worked pretty well. We had a 2 to 3 week effort after we first deployed it. We were able to get it so that we could scale it. It would linearly scale. Database size was large, but manageable. The KMS was much larger than the search database, for example, even though it basically held the same thing, which is one copy of every credential. But that was because of encryption in the KMS Plus database. Okay, so that's V1 architecture. The picture I'm showing here is the V2. This is the Aries architecture. So categories of things that we found, and I'll go over each of these. So generally slow, inability to see metrics, unable to scale linearly, premature optimizations, a thing we all want to avoid, and database size. So V2 was much slower than V1 on first go. On basically raw throughput. On a developer station, we were getting about 20% of the performance on essentially single-threaded, even on, and when we put it on OpenShift and ran a 1.1.1.1 configuration, it was much slower. The things that we went to in thinking about it and the things we jumped on is, oh, this is how we're going to address this, ACCUPY performance. How fast was this going? What are the internal processing that's going on? What else can we do? Big thing we did there was updated. We had a performance demo, which would exchange 300 credentials. We did it more or less as a demo. And what we did with that was added a pile of timing information to it. So we could get a lot more information, interesting things out of it. The Aries protocol obviously added many, many more calls. So no, issuer was, for every credential request, there was a series of calls made back and forth because there's three steps for every issuance in the Aries protocol. So much more data going back and forth across. So we saw that as an issue and tried to optimize that. And then the KMS Plus databases were storing so much more data. Big thing there being protocol state was going into the KMS Plus databases. So I'll talk about that in a bit. We did a pile of optimizations and cleanup. At first, we got workstation performance pretty much close to V1, not far off, but overall system performance when we put it on the cluster was better, but not near V1. So now we got to look at what are the potential bottlenecks in the system. And the thing you find when you look at this is there is just a ton of queues in here, first and potential bottlenecks. Obviously, any component that's non-scalable could reach a maximum. So databases, issue controller, event monitor. Internal components within ACCUPY have a pile of queues in them. Basically, the Indie SDK has a queue in it, which is essentially a black box to us. So it is, every time you make a request to the Indie SDK, it goes to a central dispatcher, and that dispatcher handles one request at a time. So it becomes serialized. There's an outbound transport queue. So every time you finish a process, you pass it on, it sits in a queue until it can be processed and sent out on an HTTP transport. And then anything between the controller and the issuer also gets put into a queue and passed serially through. So we're processing those. We've got system components. We've got load balancers in there, HTTP APIs. We've got an event queue at the very beginning that is pushing events into the system. Obviously, when it's we do some work to batch the or to limit the amount of work that gets put into the system. So we're only doing chunks of work at a time to prevent overflowing the system. But the result of that is there's many, many possible bottlenecks in there, lots of theories to chase down as to what could possibly be. You know, you basically have a team that's sort of thinking, oh, it could be this. Let's go look at that. A big lesson we found is highly advised when you're in this type of environment, basically a complex adaptive system, is really keep a repository of the data you've collected. What were the input parameters? What did you try to do? And then what were the conclusions? What metrics came out of it? Because we did have several times where we revisited ideas only to discover, oh yeah, we've looked at that before from a slightly different angle and we really already knew this. We didn't gain anything from the experiment. Inability to see metrics and understand what was going on is a real issue. It's really hard with these components are, you know, pretty robust and they're, you know, I think they're, you know, production ready, but it's really hard to see what's going on in them. And there isn't enough way of exposing that information. And that resulted in lots of theorizing, as I said, and experimenting, adding monitors, some of them one-timers, because it was just easier to do a one-time database query to check on something while we were going than to come up with a way to build a long-term way of collecting that information, but some of them were also long-term. Oftentimes it was just easier just to say, well, this theory is possible, let's just implement it and observe it. That can be a dangerous thing to do. If you don't know why you're making a change, if you're not certain the change will have an impact and what that impact will be, it's kind of dangerous to go down that path of let's just try it. We focused a lot on the database, and I'll talk a little bit about why we did that. It was much, much bigger than before, and we had to do some things about that to address the database issue. The result of that effort was we had better performance monitoring tools. We had a pile of improvements again, but mostly localized, and we still weren't getting getting the end-to-end scalable performance we had wanted to get and what we were seeing in the V1 version. One of the things we learned, I'm going to talk about this I think later, but we don't keep the protocol state around. So the original idea was as we were running, the issuer would run all the protocol and then it would have a protocol state object. We had to persist that because if you have many issuers, you have no idea which instance of an issuer is going to pick up the response to the protocol. So you can't keep it in memory. We put it all in the database and assumed we would just keep them forever because databases are cheap. But it turns out it's a massive amount of encrypted storage that you're using. And not only that, but the KMS Plus is not a place to keep long-term protocol state around. The controller is given that information on every request, and it should be the controller that decides whether to keep it or not. So this is one of the discoveries we made, is making sure that we were not doing things in the agent that is best left as a policy decision for the controller to decide what to do in a given use case. So So what that means is we kept the protocol state during the execution of the protocol, but as soon as the protocol completed, we would delete the protocol state from the KMS Plus. Does that make sense? Okay. This was a big one we ran into, and this is more about Kubernetes scaling, but basically, if you look at the numbers here, we would find that if we had a 1-1-1, we'd get 100 credentials a minute. A 1-2-1, we'd get to 160. So in this case, the bottleneck is in the issuer. In this case, the bottleneck is in the holder. Then we would increase both, and we'd get back to being the bottleneck on the issuer, and so on. When we hit 800, it turned out we maxed out, and we would no longer scale. So we literally would have flatlined at 800 creds per minute. And for quite a while, we were flatlined there. Again, lots of theories, lots of tech spiking. We found we always needed to test on the cluster because we would do fixes that would work locally and we would think they would work and move on basically, and then discover, oh, when we actually tried this on the cluster, when we're actually doing the full scaling, the fix didn't do anything but a local improvement. Big discoveries turned out, sticky HTTP requests was one big issue that we had. So, if you've got 8 instances of this and 8 instances of this, some of them would always be sending the same, the messages to the same instance of these. And so you were not getting load balancing across these. When you scale on Kubernetes, you basically stick a load balancer in front of these and it distributes the messages. Python defaults to applying a sticky bit in the header, and you wind up not load balancing. So again, it was difficult to see that. It took an actual scanning of the logs, the web logs, to determine that. And then the second one was, this was really kind of funny. We didn't change anything V1 to V2 here, but we discovered at some point that we were running out of connections. And this database was preventing us from scaling linearly, basically. It would get a certain number of requests, send over to the search database, but because we had a connection pool with a limited number of connections, it would stop scaling and wind up with queuing up here. So we were slowing down. As soon as we increased the number of connections, that problem went away. We got back to scaling. A couple of minutes left, so I'll keep going. Premature optimizations, caching is hard. We had a bunch of caching and batching in V1, so in our first cut of doing V2, figuring that there'd be many, many more calls and things to be made, you know, the change from custom protocols to Aries protocols, we actually wound up discovering that the caching and batching was actually increasing our hits on the database and actually decreasing performance. We finally decided just throw it all away, go back to pure Aries protocols, and then sometime later when we have time, we'll look at seeing if we can improve from there, but stop trying to be fancy and just going simple and you trust the Aries protocols. We did that. Tagging policy was an idea to reduce space. There's a little bit on here, I won't go a lot into there, but basically the tagging policy did not work. We should be removing that from the Indie SDK or possibly changing it slightly. I'm going to talk to Stephen Klump about possibly what to do with that. The KMS Plus database, the Indie wallet as it's called, but I hate that name. Many, many objects. We were getting 40x objects per credentials, which just blew us away when we first thought about it. But when we actually got to it, it's something like one item, the credential itself, 3 tags about the credential, and then 2 tags per claim in the item. So it actually makes sense. We did this through trial and error. It would have been good to know that. And it's interesting where we should put information as we discover it, how to evaluate that, where that should go in the community so that people don't have to discover that when they need to know. So many queries, inserts, index, we were certain it had to be database issues because so much was going on. We did a lot of focus on that. We had somebody look at that for quite a while, gather metrics, and so on, configure things. What we discovered with an addendum that I've got is Postgres is pretty great, and the database model is actually pretty simple. And in the end, we decided, you know, we just have to trust it because it's actually been rock solid as far as optimizing. Size was a big deal. Here's a page on size. Net of it was the only real change we made, as I said, was not saving protocol state longer than we needed to. Once the protocol finished, stop saving the object, and if necessary, the controller can do long-term storage in a different database. The thing to remember, though, about protocol state is it is basically the same data as credentials. So if you feel that credentials must be encrypted, then your protocol state must also be encrypted. So something to keep in mind with that. Inability to see data in a database. I hear this a lot, that developers want a mode to be able to see the database. We have not needed that very often, except when we've really, really needed it. So it's kind of a tricky one. I don't think it's a long-term thing that we absolutely need, but there's times where we had, and basically our developers came up with ways to hack it, to be able to get access to keys and be able to see it. Summary, and then I've got an addendum to this, so almost done. Maxing out the hardware, we're now at 2,000 credentials per minute and scaling linearly. Still not enough, but we need to move on and do other things. It's amazing how quickly we literally went from a Thursday, Friday in distress about how horrible it was to actually having a fix on a Monday morning where we just completely ignored this issue from then on. So it's amazing how quickly you put it behind you, but we're still not where we want to be. Don't overuse the KMS, talked about that a couple of times. Check defaults again. we didn't check defaults on how Python handles the sticky bit on HTTP. We didn't check connection defaults and things like that. A setting that we had used in the V1 configuration, we didn't change for V2 because we didn't think, oh, nothing changed over there. Making sure you're covering the whole thing. We do believe throughput, agent throughput is still an issue, and so we're really looking forward to breaking up the Indy SDK. And we've made a number of improvements in ACAPI as a result of this and continue to look for things we can do. But we hope that the Indy SDK thing is really a big thing that will help get rid of that key serialization point. This kind of goes to that same, but build enterprise agents to auto-scale, stateless and persist state. The things we made non-scalable, like the issuer controller, it truly was never a bottleneck, and we were pretty confident of that. But as soon as you have something that you can't scale, you think maybe it's a problem. Trust the database. You do have to monitor it. We have an addendum where there's a little bit of a description in here, but basically a proof request basically shut down the system because of the complexity of the generated SQL. Ian found actually a pretty good fix for it by reordering the query that didn't technically make any difference in the query, but did wind up with 100 times performance improvement and no impact based on the size of the record count. So that was cool. And that's all I have, and I'm 1 minute over, so I apologize for that, but I hope that was helpful.
Stephen, that was. There's not many of us that are yet at that scale for things, and so being able to learn some from the work that you've done is incredibly helpful. Thank you for that.
Cool. Glad to do it.
I really appreciate that your use case is so much different than the use case that Evernim's been targeting, and so you're hitting it with a totally different performance profile. Really interesting.
Anyone want to hit things on Rocket Shack? Glad to answer any questions about this.
Awesome. Thanks, folks, and we will see you online and on the call next week. Hope your week is a great one.